I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to the Signal of Noise podcast on ProSound Web, sponsored by Blue Microphones. I'm Keith Clark, editor of ProSound Web and Live Sound International, and I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Lawrence, who's the technical editor of PSW and LSI and an accomplished audio professional in his own right.
Hi, everyone. How you doing? That music that you heard on the way in was Break Free by Mike Green. You can hear more from Mike at mikegreen.bandcamp.com.
All righty. Our guest today is Jim Yakubowski, who has spent more than 35 years as a live sound engineer, and he's worked with a who's who stable of artists, Van Halen, Journey, Avril Lavigne, Peter Frampton, and many, many others. And he's also the author of Professional Sound Reinforcement Techniques, which provides a collection of tips and techniques for mix engineers. And it is available on Amazon. And Jim is also a contributing author now, increasingly, to Live Sound and Pro Sound Web. So we wanted to catch up with him about what he's doing at present, which is very interesting, and also follow up on a couple few recent articles that he has authored for our publications. So hello, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. It's an honor to be here with you, and I'm looking forward to some good conversation.
Very good. So where are you right now, physically located?
I am in Denver, Colorado. We have a day off today, and we do a show tomorrow, and it is part of the Roy Orbison In Dreams hologram tour.
So how's the snow? Is it still out there in Denver?
It is. It's been a kind of a crazy week, because I live in Greenville, South Carolina, just outside of there in Anderson, and we have not had fall yet there. It just seems like it's just been blazing hot right up until the day I left, and then I flew to Edmonton, Canada, and there was quite a bit of snow on the ground when I landed, and it was 17 degrees, and there has been snow everywhere we've been for the past week since I landed in Edmonton. We were in Calgary. We played Grand Forks, North Dakota, and spent the night last night in Lincoln, Nebraska. On the way to Denver, there's been snow all the way across. So I have been robbed of fall.
Well, we were talking last week. You filled me in a bit on this Roy Orbison tour, and I know it's a performance featuring a hologram of Roy Orbison, and it's an entire concert performance. But maybe you can take it from there and explain a little bit to our audience what it is you're actually up to from a sound reinforcement standpoint.
All right. Well, it's pretty interesting, and it's quite challenging. It's one of the most challenging things I've ever done, actually. So the hologram is great to see. It really is quite stunning to watch, and it is tied to some recorded vocals, obviously, which come to us through a Pro Tools system, and then everything else is live. So we have about a 6-piece band. Pretty close to 20 inputs of local band information. And then we have about 45 inputs of orchestra. So with the playback tracks and the backup tracks that come from video, we're close to like 85 inputs on this thing. And basically you sit in a seat, you see a hologram image of Roy performing, and you get a live band, a full orchestra, and it's pretty neat.
You know what I think is really interesting about that Jim, is that I think a lot of us have dealt with a live vocal over backing tracks, but this is really the opposite, if you think about it, right? I mean, you've got a pre-recorded vocal. That seems like it would probably be pretty tricky to sort of get it to fit.
Yeah, it is. And I would say that the toughest thing about it really is the, from a recording standpoint, you know, these tracks were recorded over decades. So some of them sound, you know, fantastically modern and crisp and clean and mastered. And some of the older ones sound a little rough around the edges. And some of them even have some effects printed to the track. So it's a little different, but overall the folks who did the mastering of these, his vocal track did an amazing job. And aside from a little bit of tonal difference from song to song, it's pretty nice to work with. But yes, it's tough to fit in with the live vocals because we do have two background singers, female background singers who sing with us. And so it's a little tough to fit, but when you think about the fact of Roy's vocal was just so unique anyway. It's just such a big sound, and so people, when they see it along with the image and hear the vocals, it all makes sense.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. What a unique challenge, you know. And I also think the other thing that's striking to me that you know that you would be unique about this application is that yes, the tonal variance in the vocal, I think, you know, that's something that comes up a lot, but you know exactly what it's going to be now. It's the same thing every night. It's coming off playback, so you're not, you know, no one's right. Changing their grip from night to night, or it's not, you know, it's not a room bleed thing. It's not, oh, you know, he's not feeling well tonight. So it seems right. Like, you know, once you kind of have a grip on, you know, throughout the show what's going on in terms of the changes, you could sort of anticipate that and get out in front of it either with programming or automation or whatever you're going to do and sort of kind of meet that head on, so to speak.
Yeah, some of the normal challenges of mixing any vocal live, some of the things you mentioned, you know, microphone technique and how someone's feeling and how far the PA is upstage compared to the, you know, where if does the singer walk out on the proscenium of the theater, or as a lot of shows have now, a 60-foot, you know, walkway out in front of the PA into the house, that kind of thing. None of that is anything to have to worry about. The challenge is shifting gears slightly. The challenge is that we are carrying a very accomplished conductor and a very accomplished drummer, and every other musician on the stage is picked up locally every day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a big day. It starts at 10 o'clock, with a rehearsal as far as the musician side of things go. So we load in usually around 8 o'clock and we set up a rehearsal room somewhere other than on stage. So the first one at the Wiltern in LA, we used the lobby. Some of these other venues, the Jubilee Auditoriums in Edmonton and Calgary, they had a great, you know, orchestral rehearsal room. So we set up there, but basically we set the whole, show up, drums, guitars, percussion, and all the chairs for the orchestra, and they do a rehearsal. And what we've got set up now is a little laptop and an AVIOM system, and they get Click and Roy's vocal, the rhythm section, we call them the rock band part of it. They get that, and then the orchestra follows the conductor. But so they rehearse for, you know, 2.5 hours, take an hour lunch break, and we move all the gear onto the stage and do a whole other sound check and rehearsal pretty much right up till doors, and then a show. So it's a pretty big day.
It sounds it. You know, I did a touring dance production recently, and you know, I think a lot of people don't realize often with these types of tours, when you come to the show, you're seeing really the second performance of the day in a way, because they came in, you know, they we do all the things that we usually do, the lighting focus and all that stuff. But all the dancers came out and the musicians came out and they rehearsed and they did the whole show. And then they went and they ate. And then, you know, we opened the doors and they come out and they do the whole show again. And so, so you know, it's got to be very, you know, I haven't had to do that on an extended basis like you're doing right now. And even after one or two days of it, it's pretty fatiguing. So I can't imagine.
Well, luckily we've got some space between shows. Just the way it was booked, we have, you know, a travel day between most shows, or you know, some two travel days. So it's been okay. We've been able to catch up a little bit, but we do have a couple like four in a rows and things like that coming up, and we should yeah, we should be pretty pooped by the end of four in a row of doing that. But I got to tell you that the most challenging thing with all of it is just the variables. You start getting that many string players and brass players and a percussionist and guitar players and a bass player and a keyboard player, and you get all these people locally and they all play different and they all play with different intensity, their interpretation of they're all playing to sheet music, and it's like a living, breathing thing every day. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to get, even though we do a sound check and a rehearsal. It sounds a little bit different every day. You got a different room, a different PA, and a different orchestra and rhythm section. So it's been a really fun, challenging thing. And, I've really enjoyed it so far. It's kind of pushed me a lot to sort of up my game.
That does sound really neat, you know, and a lot of the stuff I do is one-offs for, you know, colleges, that type of spring meltdown tours, you know, where it's bands are coming in and I work with them and I may see them again and I probably won't. So it's not that I'm pulling up a show file a lot of the time. And so, you know, I'm thinking about what you're saying, which is, I don't really know what's going to come out of this guitar player's amp until he starts to play, you know, and then it's sort of like, well, let's try to fit this in and okay, let's hear what the bass sounds like. And, you know, by the second or third song, you're like, okay, I got it. I think I understand the sound they're making and the way they're expressing themselves musically and how that fits in a larger mix. But, you know, to try to navigate that every night within the playback, I think would be very interesting. So that's really cool. I'm glad you're having a good time with it, Jim.
Yeah, I really am. It's a great show if you get a chance to come and see it. The orchestration, the arrangements of the music is really beautiful. So if you like his music, there's some good, you know, some good rock edge at times, and then some really nice sweeping string arrangements and things going on. So it's a nice show to see, and it's not a really super long show. And so we actually have. You had mentioned in my bio there that I did some work with Peter Frampton. So the last couple summers, I've been working with Peter, and our production manager, John, he ended up going to be a part of Bass Hologram, who are the producers of this show. And so we were looking for an opening act to just kind of, you know, warm up the night. And we have worked with Peter's son, Julian Frampton, before on Peter's acoustic tour. He's had his son Julian out being the opener on that. So we've got him again on this thing. So he comes out and does about a half hour of acoustic and vocals. And so it's a nice show. It's about the right length. And I think the attendees are really enjoying it.
So, Jim, we'd really like to get to this article that you've written, your retro mixing article, in just a minute. But I really want to get your two cents on is, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, it seems tricky because the artist can never see their own show live. And, you know, a recording doesn't really sound like the show sounded. So the artist is really trusting you in the room to deliver their sound. And a lot of people say, well, you know, is the artist, are they very demanding about what they want? Or do they just say, well, make me sound good? And I found it really varies. And so I was, you know, what's the split for you out of the artists that you've worked with, a lot of, you know, very well-known accomplished pop artists and rock artists, how many of them are saying, we trust you, just make us sound good? And how many are right there saying, can we tweak a little bit of this? And what's their feedback like? I find that interesting.
Yeah, it is quite quite a split, I would say. Some artists really do just sort of hand you the keys to the car and say, you know, it's all you, go for it. And then others will ask for, you know, a stereo mix of the show off the console with maybe a little audience mics or something, or they'll, you know, want to come out front and listen a little bit to the multi-track playback, where that's the closest representation you're going to get using a virtual sound check. But not often. I really haven't found that last instance to happen very much. In one case, I actually had to convince the band to come out front and listen to the playback. And it was really strange. It was just because we had designed the PA around being extremely clean and controlled on stage. We used a cardioid flown subarray and all the stuff to try to clean up the stage, because the band had had a little trouble on the previous tour with another PA of just too much low end rolling around on the stage. So they sort of said, you know, when we go on this tour, would you try to design the PA around being, you know, super clean? And so I did that, and I apparently took it a little too far, because it was they had gone from some live drums to using, you know, packing peanuts and stuff in the drums and triggered sounds, and it was just really sort of sterile on stage, and they didn't believe that the PA sounded as big as it did. So had them come out one time and hit the space bar and play back, you know, couple songs off the top of the show, and they said, okay, we get it. You know, this is all working the way we hoped it would. So, but yeah, I find most, you know, a lot of artists are smart enough. The ones I work with anyway, I work with a lot of sort of, you know, artists that are a little bit older, and they seem to understand that, you know, a board tape doesn't quite do it. And, you know, if they're best friend is a guitar player and they go out front, they might not think there's not enough guitar in the mix, and the drummer friend thinks there's not enough drums in the mix, you know. So right. they kind of usually have a couple friends who they trust to say, yeah, things are balanced nicely. And so I found I haven't been pressured too much in the last 10 years or so about questions about the mix and that kind of stuff.
So let's get to your article, Retro Mixing and the 10 Channel Challenge, I believe is the title of it. Keith, you're welcome to correct me on that.
That's it. That's the title. And it will be featured in the upcoming, in other words, November issue of Live Sound International. And for our audience out there, I've already posted it on Pro Sound Web. So if you're on the podcast page, you will see a link to this article. So you can just click on over and read it either while we're talking here or, of course, afterward or whenever you like. Or, hey, you know, if you like to wait and the suspense of it all, wait for November issue of Live Sound International. All of that said, let's carry on. Tell us about, kind of not just the article itself, but kind of the genesis of your thinking here.
Yeah. Yeah, this came from an educational process that I used with some students that I had when I worked with a church in South Carolina, and their students had been taught mostly by one gentleman who had been there since the start of the church, who was a very good mixer, and but he enjoyed using a fair amount of plugins. He liked to use some some complicated routing and some this plugin will do this and this will do this and this will do this, and now we got four plugins on one channel. And he sort of taught them as they came from being volunteers up to being an engineer on their own at a new campus that had been launched, and they'd sort of only learned one way. And honestly, overall, all of the church campuses, they had a very consistent sound that they sort of called their own, and it really did sound like a big rock concert mix at your Sunday church service. And so what they were doing worked great. And so when I was brought in, I just thought, well, you know, a lot of these guys have never sort of just had the audio 101 class, which is, you know, how did we do it back when there was nothing but analog consoles and, you know, insertable compressors and gates and EQs and stuff like that. So I tried to kind of take a bit of time when I would work with each guy individually or a few of them at a time and just sort of strip it down and try to get some of their techniques back to basic. Let's you know, look at a vocal mic and let's take off all the plugins and let's just bring it up in the PA and use three simple tools, the gain knob, the high pass filter, and the fader basically. And we stayed away even from using EQ, any light compression, any of that kind of stuff. It was just, let's just see what this vocal sounds like if you bring it up in the PA and you roll a high pass filter up on it. So that's how it started. And the 10 channel challenge was sort of evolved out of, let's just see how good we can make this church band sound with just 10 channels. You know, pick your 10. You can use kick, snare, hat, one guitar mic from each guy, bass, some keyboards, and a vocal. And you got 10 channels. You can't use any EQ, compression, gating. All you got is a gain knob, high pass filter, and a fader, and see what you can do. And it was really enlightening to see how great we could make the recording. We would do multi-track virtual sound check playback of the band's performances, and these guys would mix away with 10 channels, and it was really cool. And I think it opened their eyes to, you know, maybe not for the rest of their mixing lives, not using a lot of plugins and over EQing things, but it showed them how good of a mix they could put together by just doing it in a very simple way.
You know, there's a couple of things that are really relevant for me personally. Number one is this concept of, you know, putting salt on the meal before you taste it, which I've been guilty of, you know, countless times. And, this is my, you know, this is how I EQ this vocal. Well, let me really listen to this vocal first. And you know, it's a different singer or it's a different mic. And so maybe I usually have that cut at 800 or whatever, but I don't have it today, and you know, for whatever reason. And so listen to what you have before you start doing stuff to it. And that's right. You know, something that I see a lot of people that are just beginning doing, and I catch myself doing it. And it was funny, I was just telling Keith earlier, I was mixing, I recently mixed a band, my buddy's band, in a very, very small room, that, like, just bigger than my bedroom, very small venue. And it was one of those venues where you go, like, well, we're just going to settle for, let's get everything audible. You know, that's where we're going, because the drums is just too loud in the room, and there's nothing you can do, and it's just going to be loud. And so, right. You know, we got through the gig, and they multi-tracked it. And so I sat down last night, I went up to the studio, and I pulled the tracks up, and I had previously thrown a mix together just to send it to the guys in the band and just say, you know, here's kind of what we got. Here's what we got out of it. It's not mixed, but, you know, I just threw a quickie, and it didn't sound good. It just sounded really bad. And they're like, they didn't want to say anything to me, but I knew it. I'm like, oh, this isn't good. So last night I went up and I dragged the tracks into a new project, and I bypassed everything. And I just said, let me put the faders up and let me hear what we have. And I just threw the faders up, and I did some balancing of level, and that's really about it. And I said, you know what, this isn't bad for, you know, it's live, there's going to be bleed in the vocals, and there is, but, and the guitar player came down, and he said, that sounds pretty good. And I said, you know what, it really actually does. And so it's one of those situations where if you don't really monitor what you're doing, it's very easy, especially nowadays with all of the digital, you know, accoutrement that we have, it's really easy to just slap a compressor on where you maybe don't really need one, or, you know, add a cut where you maybe don't really need a cut. And I ended up with, like you said, high-pass filters. One or two cuts here and there. I did a little bit of phase alignment on the drums, you know, that type of basic stuff. But because despite the room being so nasty, I was very careful with where I put the mics and what mics I chose and that type of thing. And so, you know, in a way, that's 90% of it, I really think. And so I was guilty of not taking my own advice, which is listen to what you have before you start messing with it. And so it's very timely that you're mentioning this in your article, this, because it is really a great exercise. And I would even say, I would go so far as to say that, you know, when I'm frustrated with the mix, with the sound that I'm getting, especially in the studio, you know, sometimes you got to kind of dial it back a little bit and just say, well, let's go back to the source here and let's listen to the source. And really, what is the source telling us that it needs? You know, let's start there.
Right. Right. And like the old school guys used to do, you know, especially in the studio, it's like, well, if this vocal is a little too brash here or is lacking something there, you know, let's first try a different mic on this person. You know, we don't, as live guys, we're in combat half the time and we don't get to do a lot of that kind of stuff, especially if you're in a festival situation or, like you said, you know, you just got three or four bands who are going to, you know, come up and just drag a guitar amp out of their car and throw it up there. I mean, you know, you put a standard microphone on it and you just start twisting knobs. I mean, it's what you have to do a lot of the time, but a well-placed and well-selected microphone is half the battle sometimes. And, you know, a great, tuning job on a drum kit and, you know, the proper dampening of the kick drum and the overtones of the toms and those types of things. And then, having great musicians playing is usually the final piece of the puzzle that can get you to having a great sounding mix. If you've tuned the PA well and you've done all these other things and then you put some great musicians on there, you can really find that you don't have to do a whole lot. But I will also raise my hand and say I'm very guilty of pre-dialing in some EQs. I mean, certain things like a kick drum or, you know, a vocal, we sort of see over time a pattern in how we EQ those things. And so a lot of times, especially if you're rushed and you're not going to get a really long sound check through the PA, you'll just go along and dial all those EQs in just to sort of get ahead of the game. And that's totally cool. But like you said, this is really an exercise. It's a, you know, I'm not going to change the way I mix overnight, but this is an exercise in just trying a different, more simple, less cluttered approach and see what you get out of it and see if you learn anything, because that's really what it's about.
Right. You know, and that is it. And another reason that I, you know, having to admit now that I fell victim of my own problems is I teach that way. I say, let's start with the gains. Let's put the faders up. Let's turn the gain up. Let's see what we get. Okay, now let's add the high pass. Okay, now let's go, you know, to the pan knobs if you're in a studio and start there. Mm-hmm. And then you add, now we'll see how much further we can go with EQ. Now we'll see how much further we can go with compression. And so you really have to really learn how to use each tool to the maximum that you can use it and get as much mileage as possible before you go to that next thing. And so, you know, there are absolutely situations when I would love something like a dynamic EQ. It's a very, very useful tool for a specific situation, but I don't pull that out unless I've tried everything else first and it still needs work. Then I'll go there. You know, I don't slap that on every channel to start with. And I think that's a big difference. And I also, I have a little bit of a theory that a lot of the people that say they don't like the sound of digital mixes, I don't think it's the digital, so to speak. I think it's the fact that there's so much processing that's available so easily that they're just, people tend to just use it because it's there. And so I think that it's not the digital sound necessarily. I think it's the sound of processing that maybe is not needed. You know what I mean? And so that's, you really had to, and I think you mentioned something similar to this in your piece. You used to really have to want that compressor. You really, really had to want it because you had to go get it and you had to mount it in the rack and you had to patch it in, you had to check the gain and you had to get the little, you know, insert cable going. And now it's, you click a button and you have a compressor. And so that sort of, is this really worth it? Do I really want this? That intent, you know, the sense of deliberance that you're using to say, I need this certain processor in this spot, that's sort of, you can short circuit that now. And whether or not you really need it, it's really easy to just have it. And so, you know, my caution to myself is make sure you really want it. You know, instead of just hitting that button, pretend that you still have to go get it and patch it and mount it and do all that stuff. And if you still want it, then hit the button.
Right. Right. And a lot of this isn't just something that is relative to digital world. I remember some situations where, you know, friends of mine or, you know, we'd be on a tour and the opening act, you know, front of house engineer would be really struggling with the vocal or something. I just can't get the vocal to pop, you know, and sit on top of the whole mix. And, you know, would you be so kind as to just kind of have a look at what I'm doing and see what you think? And I would say that the one trick that works almost every time to help someone who's having that problem is bypass on all the plugins or the inserts. And again, same thing, you know, flatten the EQ, turn it up, get the high pass to a nice frequency where you're getting rid of some low end junk, and just turn it up. And it usually will sit on top of the mix so much better. And, you know, back in the analog world, I remember some guys having a, you know, 27 band EQ and, you know, maybe like a Focusrite vocal channel, you know, a multi-unit where you had a little EQ and some compression and some de-essing and all these things. And they would be, you know, they would be like six layers of processing deep on a vocal mic. And just can be just as guilty in the analog world as in the digital world. But, you know, you had, like I said, you had to work at it harder back then. Get the cables, get, you know, mount it in the racks, just, you know, all of it, get it approved in the budget. You know, that's another thing. If you want six pieces of processing for your vocal, you know, you have to have enough space and a budget at front of house to have all that stuff. So, but yes, in digital world, so much easier now to overdo it. And I think you're right. It's not always just the sound of a digital console's preamp. It's the latency and the phasing and the interaction of all these different plugins that can cause a problem. And like you said, simple use of your favorite tools, like a multiband compressor, a tube compressor, or, you know, just a gate that you love with just the right setting that you know so well. The proper use of plugins across channels by somebody who's really spent the time to learn how to make that plugin work for you in the best way is fantastic. And and it's all about approach. Again, this is a challenge. Try this, see if you learn anything. But I know guys who use tons of plugins and have absolutely stunning mixes, and then I know guys who use almost nothing and have, same can be said in a negative way. Some, you know, some guys don't use a lot of anything and they just are having trouble. So if you develop a style of mixing, whatever it is, simple or complicated, if that works for you, great. But I think if you're struggling and having problems, I think it's really a good idea sometimes to strip it all back and kind of start from scratch.
Well, you know, I for one will say that definitely bailed me out, you know, as recently as yesterday. And so hopefully if our if our listeners or the readers of your article, you know, try this, I would be interested in hearing, you know, the results of what they take away from that. Which also, I think this is a good segue to, I think, the other thing that we wanted to talk about with you today, Jim, which is, you know, our favorite road stories. And, you know, this discussion has made me think. I was mixing this very small outdoor festival way in upstate New York, and it was one of those, like, you know, don't turn into the wrong, if you miss the cornfield, you've missed the festival type of thing. It was a very small little festival. And, you know, I was the system tech, and sometimes as a system tech, you've got to mix the openers. And so I was mixing the openers, and the headliners, front of house guy shows up, and he comes out, and we're kind of talking a little bit, and he's setting up his gear. And, you know, I looked at him and I said, "Does that sound okay to you? Because I feel like I'm over compressing my bass." And he says, "Yar," like, like, yep, which was amazing to me because he had already listened to it and he had already realized that. And he didn't say anything because he was sort of letting me, you know, as the young gun, kind of mess it up for myself. And as soon as I said that, he said, "Yep." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Well, here's what I would do." And he went in and he threw my headphones on. And I threw his headphones on. He said, "Well, come in and you put the EQ cut here and then you don't have to compress." And so he went in and he already knew exactly what I was doing wrong and exactly how to fix it. And he, you know, sort of just kept it to himself until I asked, which was, I thought, very cool of him, but also equally cool for him to jump in and say, "Well, yeah, you know, here's what I would do." And he, of course, was right. And, of course, sounded better after. And it was the classic case of, you know, "I don't like this sound, so I'm going to just add more processing to it." You know, that's what I was doing. That's what I was doing. I was like 21 years old, and that's what you get sometimes. And so he bailed in and, you know, he got me out of there. And, you know, what's amazing is he said, you know, "Look," he said, "everyone comes to the table with their own recipe, and this is just kind of my way of doing it." And what was funny is at the same show I had, you know, like you mentioned earlier, I had a cardioid subarray, and he hadn't seen one of those. And so he was sort of looking at me funny, and he was like, I don't know, kind of afraid to ask. And he said, "Can I ask you what's going on with that?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, it's cardioid subarray." And I sort of explained how it works real quick. And he went and he walked around the stage and he went around the back. And he came back and he said, "Oh, that's pretty incredible." He said, "I've never heard anything like that." So, you know, we were both sort of able to have the humility to say, "I don't understand what's going on here." And we were both able to sort of offer some knowledge that we had. And we both walked away from that, you know, having learned something. And those are the situations that can very easily turn into a contest or territorial battle. And it didn't. Right. And that was, you know, if I think back of all the gigs that I've worked on, that was one of my coolest experiences was that. Sort of just let's both kind of get together here and let's both share what we know and let's both leave better, you know?
Absolutely. And that's one of the greatest things about working with the same people all the time. And this goes all the way from, you know, the club and sort of college theater level all the way up to big tours is, you know, you tend to get to know the people that are in your circle. So on a big tour, you know, it may go 4, 5, 6 months and you may be the opening act audio engineer or the, you know, the headliner, but you're working side by side with this person every day. And everyone I've ever worked with who I've worked with for any length of time, I always take stuff away. I can almost say that daily I take something away from watching them work and a slightly different approach to something, different system engineers, the way they tune PAs. And so it's an awesome thing when there is that partnership that goes on an audio team. And, you know, on a big festival, if it's, you know, if there's 3 or 4 bands, on a big festival, 5, 6 bands, you know, you can kind of walk out front and listen to everyone's mix and just kind of stand back and look over their shoulder and see what they're doing. And there's always something to be learned. And like you said, there's no right way. Everyone has their recipe. They all have their way. I mean, a good analogy, for me, cause I just love to play golf is a golf swing, you know? I've seen some guys with some crazy golf swings who can just pound it, you know, 300 plus yards because they have figured out a way to make that motion work for them. And you might be struggling with, you know, hitting the ball down the middle of the fairway and say, you know, "Can you give me some pointers?" Well, they may be able to give you some pointers, but at the same time, they may not be able to because their movement, their whole golf swing might be so different from the way you do it. So some things are kind of universal. I think there's some really good audio fundamentals like gain structure and you know, getting a PA tuned up nicely to start the day. I think there's a lot of things like that everyone should have a pretty good grip on. And then there's guys who mix with a lot of style and flavor, and their way may not work for you. So, but if you'd like me to throw a good road story, and I was trying to
think this over when you guys had mentioned it earlier. And I think one of my favorites was actually the very first night I ever mixed a band. And I was in, it was 1981. I was in living in Vancouver, Canada, and I was taking recording school at Columbia School of Broadcasting up there in Vancouver. And I had every intention to be a recording engineer. So didn't really have much of a thought of ever being a live sound guy. But a buddy of mine got a job with a band as a singer, and they were getting ready to go on tour. I had another job at a grocery store, and they just kind of said, hey, you know, you're going to audio school. We're all kind of inexperienced, you know, musicians. If we can get a tour together, would you want to come out and do sound for us? So that was how I diverted my path to live sound. But a few things that you don't learn necessarily in recording school that are very valuable in live sound. One of those things is, you know, controlling feedback. So we had a sound system that was very basic. It was like a 24-channel analog console, a bunch of mics, stands, you know, a snake, and that was it. I had no processing. I had, you know, we just got out the door and we're going to start this tour. So we're doing our first show. And, you know, I'm just kind of bringing faders up and trying to balance a mix. And all of a sudden, you know, it was probably my kick drum or my floor tom started to roll, and it just started to ring. Five, 10 seconds later, I'm like, well, I better do something about that. So the only thing I really knew to do at the time was just to turn it down. So I just turned the whole mix down. And this went on for a couple songs. And then the band took a break, and they walked out front, and they could tell something wasn't good up there. And I noticed these sort of long-haired, you know, musician-type looking guys are kind of start circling the console area, and they're looking at my lack of gear for the most part. And they kind of said, hey, it sounds like you're having a little feedback trouble. And I honestly said to them, yeah, I guess I'm not really sure what's going on, because that was really my level of education on live sound at that point. And these guys said, well, you know, we actually have a little rehearsal room right up the way here, and we noticed you don't have a equalizer in your sound system. You know, we'd be more than happy to run up the road on this break and pull it out of there, and you could use it for the rest of the night. And I looked at these guys and I said, well, thanks very much, guys, but I don't see how that's going to help. And so that was how my illustrious career started out. That was night number one. So these guys walked away and ordered another beer, and that was about it.
That's a great story. And you know what? I think before we wrap up, there's something, Jim, that you and I have talked about. I think we spoke about it the first time we talked on the phone, and it's so important, and it keeps coming up that I really want to share it with everybody. This idea of they're calling it the imposter syndrome now, or this idea of, you know, every time I go out, you're sort of going in the back of your mind, do I really know what I'm doing? Am I going to screw this up? You know, maybe just, how did I get here? Am I a fraud? And you said that, you know, after all the years of doing what you've been doing and all the, you know, just absolutely top tier gigs that you've had, you still feel that way. And I think there's something that's really important about that, that, you know, hey, we're never done learning. And there's always this sense of, well, I understand what my limitations are, and I understand the things that I would like to get better at. And I think that's really one of the hallmarks of a competent person, is that you're sort of wondering, is this good enough? You know?
Right.
And here, you know, that's something that I deal with a lot. And also, you know, a lot of engineers that I talk to, particularly the younger ones, they also feel that way. And so I think it's just really important for a lot of people to hear that, you know, that doesn't necessarily go away. There may never be a point when you go like, I got this, you know, and I've mastered
right.
it. And quite honestly, I hope that I don't ever get to that point. I love continuing to learn and continuing to talk to other people and say, well, what are you doing? How do you solve these problems? And And, right. You know, what are the new techniques? What are the new products available? What are the new workflows that people are using? And that's one of the things that is a treat for me to be involved with, you know, LSI and PSW in that way, is that I really get to talk to guys like you and say, well, you know, how do you handle this? And so I just think it's really important to repeat that for anyone that may be feeling that way, which is, you know, that's a good thing, you know? So keep feeling that way, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and not only is there just, you know, if you take a little slice of the industry and you say, well, okay, I'm mixing a rock band tonight and I have this console and these tools, you know, how good am I doing and what could I be doing better? You know, everyone, I think all of us feel like we walk away from a show and there was, you know, several things we wish had gone better, you know, that night. We wish the room was better. We wish the PA wasn't quite so this or that, or, you know, doing outdoor shows. I wish the wind hadn't kicked up and blown the sound all over the place. I mean, there's always something. And when you get to have those magic nights where the room is behaving really nicely and the audience coming in has done a great thing to the reverb time in the room and tightened up the low end. And I think we've all had those nights where you just feel like, oh my gosh, this is like one of the best nights I've ever had mixing. Those are very few and far between. Most nights you're arm wrestling the room, and you're dealing with something. And then, you know, with the Roy Orbison tour, you know, I'm dealing with orchestras, which I don't have tons of experience with. And there's just all kinds of things. I do a lot of corporate events as well, and those are hugely challenging. And we all know how much networking is going on now and troubleshooting network problems and learning new consoles and, you know, techniques like, you know, subs, wrangling subs to get the best response in the room. And, you know, you can always learn something from talking to someone else or reading something else in a magazine or online. There's just so much to learn. And as long as you feel like I'm doing the best I can, but I can still be so much better, I think that's half the trick.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic advice. And, you know, I feel that way, and I'm always like, you know, what else can I learn? What else is there? you know, madly Googling what's the next big secret, you know? And there's no one big secret, but there's a lot of little tiny secrets, and they all add up and they all make you better. So, I think, Keith, is there anything else on our docket here? Cause I think we've had a great conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, just a big, big thanks to Jim, both for his time here and all the information and acumen he shared, and also for the great contributions that just keep on coming to Live Sound International and Pro Sound Web. And I've posted a link, by the way, here on the podcast page to the itinerary for the Roy Orbison show. So if you're interested, check it out. And if it's coming to your area, be sure to go check it out. Stop by and say hello to Jim. I'm sure he'd be happy to see you. So, Jim, thank you so much for everything. We really appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you, Jim.
Absolutely. My pleasure. It's been really fun, and I've really enjoyed contributing in Live Sound International. It's been a, you know, I've been a reader forever, so getting to write some stuff is just such a thrill. And I hope you guys like the stuff, and I hope to keep just putting stuff in there that helps. Education for me it's just absolutely my passion, is to pass on, a little bit of what I know that I've learned from other guys who've been willing to do the same. So, you know, great magazines and great online forums. And like you said, you know, instructional videos that you can dive into. Just keep doing it. Keep learning, and we'll all get better. And, you know, one of these days we might find a way to mix a perfect show. And it's not the easiest thing to do by any means.
All righty, Jim. Well, thank you. And thanks to our audience. And also thanks to our sponsor, Blue Microphones. We'll be back with another Signal to Noise podcast very, very soon. So stay tuned, as they say. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.